our post-game for Mark Lowe Branson. Greg, this was a good interview. I enjoyed my time with Mark. And of course, I get a lot of time with Mark on a regular basis. He's actually my mentor in my dissertation. And I have my dissertation defense coming up on June 18th. I just found out this morning that, the date's been set. So I'm hoping that... So anyway, my point is that we need to be really nice to Mark in our post game right now, because I really need to pass.
I have no doubt that you're going to pass, and many congratulations on getting to this point. I know the pain and the anguish that has gone into this arrival. So.
Well, you're in the midst of it right now. I know that you're having a writing week right now, and you're doing some final edits this whole summer. So anyway, blessings in that as well. So back to Mark's interview. That is, this is an interview, an AI interview about AI. And there are some things that kind of stood out to you and me as strengths of the interview. What were some of the things that stood out to you just right off the bat, Greg, as you're listening to the interview?
Well, okay. So let me just say, first of all, and this one we can't really give credit to Branson for this, but I just want to say, in a moment of self-appreciation for us, it's super nerdy to be doing a meta interview about the interview method. And so I really like that. I think it was a really cool way to end the first season.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that very much, but it was nice to have a real expert kind of laying out for us what's at stake in asking these kinds of questions of missiology. Yep. And of course, he wasn't talking specifically about the field of study that we've had our eye on for the whole season. Mm-hmm. But I did enjoy thinking more about, because you're more of an AI specialist. I'm definitely in the novice category with the use of the methodology, and so that was helpful to me to get a big picture of what's going on with this.
Yeah. One of the things that I appreciated about the interview is that it's clear that he's the expert, but he's also a practitioner, right? So there's this sense in which his expertise is very much, it's grounded in a bunch of different stories of things that he's done. You know, it's experiences with churches and congregations, it's consulting, but there's this sense in which, as an expert, you can't be an AI expert unless you're doing it on a regular basis, right? And living into the philosophy that undergirds it, living out of that, there are things working here and let's identify them, right? I know God is at work here. Let's identify and jump on board with what God is doing. And then helping, direct other people's attention to that. Hey guys, let's be more aware of what God is doing. So anyway, I'm curious, Greg, what kind of questions came up for you as you're thinking about, some of the things that Dr. Branson brought up, that Mark brought up?
Well, So I really liked the way that he was clear about the theological anchors for AI in its use for him as a missiologist and a professor of mission and theology, practical church. Identifying and I love the way that he kind of in astonishing concision said, missional theology has become kind of vague, so let me tell you how I understand missional theology as a practitioner of AI, right? So you have the agency of God, the subjectivity of human beings, and the localness of churches. But that's so rich, and it's such a cool...
This should be three sections of your next book on missiology, right? You're three major sections. Let's talk about God as primary agent, neighbors as subjects, and ecclesiology.
Yeah.
It's 1, 2, 3. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was really nice. Helped me understand what he imagines this practice and research method, but as much as anything, practice has to do with, in a specific way, the mission of God. But you and I were talking earlier, and you mentioned how the theological frame really makes a difference for AI. So can you say a little more about why and...
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, so in AI, right, part of what you're doing is you're walking in and you're asking, you know, what's best in this organization. More broadly, people like myself are applying it to communities. Folks like Peter Block, you know, these are good tools for working within communities, you know, but the question is, you know, what's working here, right? There are things that we can appreciate here in whatever the context happens to be in this organization. And yet what missiology does, what a mission theology does is that it grounds AI in the story, in a much deeper and more robust story. And the story is this, is that, you know, God is at work. If you don't have that theological, missiological grounding, right, that the Spirit is here, you know, long before I arrived, long after I'm gone, the Spirit is at work, whether I'm aware of what the Spirit is doing or not, you know, that right there, it helps frame AI within, you know, it helps frame with AI within a deeper meta narrative, you know, a narrative that says, I have reason to be grateful here because my God is at work, right? I there is reason, as Paul would say, right? There's reason to rejoice. And the reason that I have to rejoice is not just because, like, hey, you're great and all the things that you're doing are worth appreciating. You know, it's different, right? There's this, I know that I can fix my thoughts on those things that are true and honorable and right and pure and lovely and admirable. I can think about those things that are excellent and praiseworthy because I believe that there is a God of peace that is at work here, right? I believe that there is a God who is working to redeem the world. And so because of that, I step into situations with an appreciative approach, looking for where God is at work. Does that make sense? I don't know if that's helpful. I'm curious.
Yeah, well, I think it is, because I think it's easy to hear this as a novice and think, well, you're talking about like communal positive self-think or wishful thinking. You know, it's not very realistic, but that word is very much the point, that the theological affirmation of the reality of God, the work of God, the power of the Spirit in the world before us, before we even engage the conversation, all of those realities ground the questions that we're asking. They give reason to the belief that we will find hope, that there is a future, that something new is happening, that growth is maybe not inevitable, but certainly the right expectation.
Yes. Yeah. There is reason to move toward hope and reason to, you know, move beyond despair. Absolutely. And it's a reason that is always going to be because of God's work in the world. It's always going to be more robust for us than, for example, you know, AI as it's used in a secular context, right? Where that's gone.
Yeah. Because if I'm not mistaken, AI initially was in some sense wedded to a fairly social constructionist theory of community or organization. And yeah. So in a sense, it starts off fairly non-realistic. And while I don't personally, from my theological perspective, I don't want to lean like all the way into some sort of naive realism. Mm-hmm. But there is... Our faith confession is that God is real, mm-hmm. and so that there is something different than mere social construction undergirding our aspirations for community.
That's right. Well, in my mind, that, you know, that story that God is real and working is part of the social construction. In my mind, I like social constructionism. It's actually like the epistemology that undergirds my dissertation. But part of it is like we're deciding, look, this is the story that it's going to that's informing my imagination. And, you know, these are the stories that as we tell and retell begin to shape our practices in the world. And so, you know, absolutely. I think one of the things that that you bring up is the way that at least I've gotten the sense sometimes reading some of the AI literature that AI can feel a bit manipulative. for those who are, for instance, in the midst of an organization in the middle of crisis, you know, and if there is no deeper robust, like, you know, a more robust, like, theology undergirding it, it feels a little bit manipulative, right? You're stepping in and you're asking questions when that, questions about what to be grateful for when people are just not there, you know, and what reason have I to be appreciative? And you are asking questions, you know, that intentionally move people's attention there. I mean, you are intentionally changing. I mean, it's part of action research. Like, you're asking questions intended to change.
Yeah. Well, and I think, one of the things that's helpful about listening to Branson talk about this, and as you said, rooting it in story after story after story, community after community, real situations, is the, at least the possibility that you can recognize there are none of those situations that he was talking about that aren't full of real problems, right? So it's not hypothetical, like we're only applying AI to kind of Pollyanna situations. He's talking about churches with real conflict and real difficulty or real stagnation, whatever it is, communities with real barriers to relationship and so on. And so those problems are real, and AI appreciation as a sort of a theological practice leading into a method of discovery and innovation is a way of addressing problems, but it's almost, you would say, indirect, because it starts by critiquing our human tendency toward negativity and bogging down in trying to solve problems or critique things that deserve critique or at least deserve change, and so. But that's a little bit implicit, and so I'm hoping, you know, we can surface that point a little bit, because Branson certainly isn't belaboring the idea that there are real problems here and change is the agenda of the day. But it is. AI is about change, growth, movement, innovation, and so on.
Yeah, and I think that a couple of things help, at least help us, I think, put things a little bit into perspective, is that part of what I like about AI is that when you are, you know, you're leaning into a desire for change, a desire for adaptation, and yet you're leaning into it not with one of our, you know, managerial approaches, right? So I've got the idea. I know what change needs to happen, and I'm going to institute this change in this organization. And instead, AI is very much grounded in, you know, I believe that the conversations will themselves and the dialogue will itself, you know, help us determine the agenda for change. And I think that's helpful in honoring the agency of the people that are a part of the organization or community. That makes it a little bit less, for instance, I use the word manipulative. Well, it's not really if we do it correctly, you know, because we really are, you know, leaning into stories. But one of the things you bring up, Greg, is because, I mean, right now, these last 2 weeks have been very difficult for our country. So let's make this, like, very specific. You know, we're dealing right now with a country that is feeling very broken, very hurt, very angry. A lot of protests. There were protests right in front of my church on, you know, Melrose and Vine, just this several days this week. You know, that's in Los Angeles. And, you know, our anger at, you know, the racism, the systemic racism, the murder of George Floyd. So the question then becomes, well, what do you do? Like, clearly we have problems, right? Clearly our communities have problems. In what way would AI apply here, right? I mean, to lead with questions that are appreciative does not feel
right. Like you it would be bold is an understatement to go into a community in LA or Minneapolis or wherever and ask the Black community, you know, let's start with, what are your best experiences of the police? What do we want to take away from our best experiences?
Right.
That's a, yeah. that's not for this moment.
No.
And
no.
And the lament and the anger and all of that are, they're right.
Yep.
And another example of this, right? If you look at the prophets of Israel in the Old Testament,
mm-hmm.
it would be odd for them to go into Jerusalem and say, you know, let's think about what's been the best that we can carry forward. That's not
in the midst what of the idolatry and injustice. They walk in, right? The poor are being abused.
Yeah.
The foreigners are being, you know, taken advantage of. And they're like, so what's, you know, what's working here?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And so, and this raises the issue of when we start with God's agency, it's certainly possible that what God is doing is critical, deconstructive, retributive. I mean, there are a lot of possibilities in the narrative of Scripture for God doing things that aren't, they don't fit very well under the heading of appreciation.
Right.
And so,
yeah. Yes. That's
right. But, but we also recognize that the appropriateness of these responses right now doesn't actually speak to their constructiveness. And when we get on a community level and a local level where you have real human beings who have experienced systemic racism, acts of overt racism, acts of police brutality, and we have specific human police officers who are subjects in their communities, reconciliation from a Christian perspective is going to look somehow like listening to each other's stories and responding.
Yep. Right. Which is at the core of AI, right? I mean, let's share stories, and it makes it a little bit easier for me to hear your story if you're leading with some appreciation. And yet, you know, that's, I mean, I had a conversation yesterday with Tanya Bryce, and she is, a dean of a historic Black college, and she was sharing with me the experiences of hopelessness and of despair that her community is experiencing right now. And just that sense of, she called it story fatigue. She was like, we're tired of telling our story. You know, like, this is hard, what we're going through right now. And there's a sense in which, like, I don't want to tell my story anymore. And I think, Greg, I'm not sure if this is where you're going, like, specifically, but I think one of the ways that AI could be used at this moment would be, for instance, in a Black activist group or a group that is trying to address the injustice, that's trying to address and feeling very discouraged, right? This is a group that I'm thinking of churches, even my own congregation, that's going, what do we do? What do we do? It just feels so overwhelming right now. And in my opinion, AI is a tool, a method that may be used to help kind of redirect our attention away from the despair toward some energy that there may be there for change and for, you know, getting back into the fight, getting back into leaning back into our gifts and the things that God is doing in the world. And I think sometimes, you know, if you watch news all day, and that's the stories that you're imbibing, it can actually be very, because they're very problem oriented, right? It can be super discouraging. It can just sap energy for future change. And so as I think about, like, well, where would AI work? Well, I'm thinking about an organization like that, that's just needing some extra energy, that's needing some new, you know, movement away from despair.
So that makes me think of a couple things. One is that it's important to recognize that Tanya's story of telling her story and becoming fatigued by it is precisely one that needs to be shared. Right. It would be necessary to appreciate that story of telling her story. Mm-hmm. And so she's actually, as she's saying, "I'm so tired of telling my story," she's telling her, you her story.
Right.
And that is important. That's the kind of listening that is still constructive, because if you listen appreciatively, that can become, well, what are the times that you remember when telling your story did work? Mm. And why do you think that is? And how could we do more of that?
Yep.
Because the second thing is that, to go back to an earlier point, AI actually is a critical practice, in that if you're carrying forward what you think works and what is hopeful and so on, you are wholesale leaving behind whatever is not.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is a sort of almost a passively deconstructive process, where you're saying, this is stuff we're not carrying forward. We're done with this. This is not the new story we're going to tell.
Yeah.
And so at the same time, in that conversation, you would be saying implicitly, what practices of storytelling and what responses to storytelling are we leaving behind? Those are not what we're going to carry forward.
And that's important. That needs to be pointed out, right? This is not a Pollyanna approach. This is not everything's okay. This can be profoundly transformative in a situation that needs transformation. You know, it does imply, as you're saying, there implicit here is a perhaps a radical revision of current praxis. But that revision isn't something that's led from the top, right? And that's part of what can be so disempowering, I think, sometimes, is when someone comes in and goes, look, like, here are all the things that need to change, and here's how we're going to do it. AI, it doesn't lead like that, right? It leads with, or at its foundation is this, you know, neighbors are subjects, and we need to treat them as agents. Their stories matter. And it's in the midst of the dialogue and the conversation that we're going to experience, as we lean into those, as we, you know, develop, as we notice themes and develop propositions and lean into these experiments, you know, that's where the change is going to happen. That's how the change happens. One of the experiences that I had, that I think in many ways prepared, this would be actually before I had only had one experience of AI before this, but I took a class at Fuller Seminary during my MDiv, called Pastoral Care and Abuse, and Dale Ryan had us watching, you know, shows about just really broken family systems. You know, it's pastoral care and abuse, and so we're looking at stories of abuse in families, issues of suicide and issues of cutting. You know, it's just really heavy stuff. And he had this practice, though. His practice was, we turn off all the lights to watch the video interviews and documentaries on you know, this deep brokenness. And then he would pop the light on, and his first question, it was, and all of us felt kind of beat up at that point, right? He turns the light on and he asks, so where did you see evidence of God's grace? You know, and honestly, that question was sometimes so flooring, you know, but it's been a very important, for me, it's been very formative in my own ministry, in my own approach to participation in what God is doing in the world. It's that I know that I can walk into any situation, even in the midst of, even in the midst of racism, you know, I can walk in a system that is just completely sick and broken and warped, and I can still ask the question, where is God at work here, right? I know that there is still, even here, there is evidence of God's grace. Even here, there is evidence of God's goodness and things that that I can lean into.
Yeah, well, so let me play the role of the skeptic for a minute, so that you can, for our listeners who are listening to this and thinking, I don't know if that's adequate.
yeah.
So So what do you say to the person who responds, you're, by doing that, you know, you're making some sort of a confessional move, and that's nice, and you're being hopeful, and that's fine, but you're not addressing the problems. You're not addressing the reality of the situation, because God's grace is there, but so is a lot of other stuff. And to an extent, you're kind of just choosing to ignore that in favor of looking for glimmers of light in the darkness. How do you respond to the desire or the need, the felt need for critique and deconstruction?
One of the things that I've noticed in my own experiences of AI is that when we do ask people to share their stories, critique is there. I mean, it's kind of our natural impulse, right? I mean, you know, there are some people that I've had AI, you know, interviews with who I can ask them, like, what's been life-giving? And they're immediately going to shift to, let me tell you all the issues. Like, there are a ton of things wrong. So there's a sense in which AI pushes against what is already our natural instinct, right? We already do critique really well. That's something that, you know, we nail that. You know, we're gifted when it comes to awareness of the issues, of all the things that are broken. And that's not a full answer to a very, very important question. But it is something that, hey, you know, maybe there's another muscle here that we ought to be exercising. However,
that. Yeah, well, so let me reframe that in terms of our podcast. I think you and I would both agree that missiology has problems. There are some things, maybe many things, that are significant issues. We can name things like colonialism and, I won't list all the isms, but, you know, we have a lot of stuff going on historically and currently in both mission practice and the field of study dedicated to reflecting on mission practice. And so why is it an adequate approach, or why is it our best approach to think instead about what's been the best of missiology?
That's great. You know, I remember our early conversations and trying to think through, like, how do we want to do a podcast? You know, we don't want to be asking questions like, so tell me what you think is all messed up with our field of study. You know, like, it can end up being like a really, you know, like you're slamming everything about our field. And again, it is very firmly grounded in the conviction that even in our field, right, as many problems as we have, there are things that work, right? There are things that we know God is at work even in the midst of our field. And so let's lean into those, because there is going to be more energy for change, right? And on the other hand, you know, one of the things that perhaps needs to be mentioned is that when we do start telling stories, implicit in those stories are the crisis, right? Implicit in those stories are the, you know, as you start talking about gratitude and the things you're grateful for, you know, those stories are, every good story has a crisis, right? Every good story has, like, something went wrong, and then, you know, this is the way that it was resolved, or this is the way that I've been seeing, you know, some you know, light in the midst of this, or sometimes they don't, right? I mean, but every great story, it tends to address what is not going on, you know, correctly. So with us in our, you know, in our missiology podcast, we're thinking, like, how do we do this in a way, because Greg, you and I, and we've talked about this, we'd like to see shifts in our field of study in missiology. We'd like to see things, you know, move in a way that honors the stories and experiences of women more. We'd love for this to move in a way that honors the stories and experiences of people of color, of the Black experience. Like, you know, why aren't there more books written on missiology and racism, right? Why aren't there, there are things that we would love to see, like even things like, why is so much of our mission practice, like, not grounded in the agency of God, right? I mean, a lot of these things, very much taking seriously the fact that, you know, the idea, the story that God is at work on the ground ahead of me. Like, so how does that make a difference in the midst of my, for instance, my work of contextualization? So anyway, I think that, like, you know, for us, we're thinking, you know, missiology has things that we'd like to see changed, but it would be, I don't know if we would have as many listeners that would stick with us maybe if we just led with like, here are all the things that are wrong, especially because it's you and me, Greg, right? I mean, we're not leaders right. in the field. We're leading from a place of like, tell us stories. And again, that in and of itself, you know, reflects, you know, the way that we are attempting at least to honor the agency of people that have gone ahead of us, you know, that we're saying, hey, look, not everything is correct here, but you know, here's me and Greg and missiology.com. And we're wanting to elicit change, and we want to do it from our, you know, us being very realistic about our own power, right? Our own influence. And then also honoring of both the agency of God and the agency of other folks in our field of study.
Yeah, well, so I would push back a little bit on a couple of those points. One is, I do think that there is a market for critique and negativity. In fact, I think that's probably what sells more. That's a conscious decision on our part not to sell those goods. But I also want to affirm what you said earlier, which is we are natural born critics, and all the more so. We're not only naturally mm-hmm. born and gifted for criticism, you and I have just spent years honing those skills so that it's like breathing to us to look at right, a mission yeah. text and go like, all right, let me tell you the five ways that this is inadequate. And I think that we could right. easily do that. It exactly. would be, in fact, it would be natural for us on a website called Missiology, where there's an accent on the academic, to play that game. And there's a place for that game. I love that game. Yeah. That's my home base. So it's important that we're making a choice to say there is a constructive conversation to have here that is implicitly critical, that in which appreciation is actually critique. But we're not going to focus on problems and criticisms right now. We're going to focus on hopes and dreams.
That's right. You know, and Greg, one of the reasons that we're doing this as well, and we want missiology.com to be a hub where there is a diversity of voices, right? There are folks that are speaking into our field of study, and we're creating space for, you know, a context in which their voices can be heard, whether it's from, you know, Latin America or Africa or places that have not typically had, you know, a strong voice, at least not in North America. And I think it would be inappropriate for us to lead with critique in yeah. those situations, yeah, right? It would right. be inappropriate and unhelpful to the conversation. I mean, it tends to shut conversation down if, you know, we have an interview with a mission leader in Asia, you know, and we just pick it all apart.
Yeah.
We're like, thank you for being with us. And let me tell you now why everything you said was just absolutely off base, you know? And I think that in the midst of conversations that are grounded in the assumption of diversity, you know, we have to lead with appreciation if we want those conversations to continue. And if, so there's a very pragmatic sense in which that's important, but even from a missiological perspective, I know that as much as I might disagree with that leader from Asia, that God is at work there and I need to be paying attention.
And not only that, I don't understand everything about that context and that frame of reference, and I need to learn. I need to be a learner first, which, you know, yep. that's a missiology 101, learn first.
Yep.
And
yeah.
So, yeah, I think we're making both an appropriate and a helpful choice here. But again, I'm glad that we've spent some time thinking about why out loud and struggling yeah. a little bit with other alternatives, which have their place. You know, Mark identified as an 8 on the Enneagram. I'm probably a 5. And the way that I know that, it, more than having read and learned about it is that when I talk to people who are really into the Enneagram, I usually identify as whichever number thinks the Enneagram is silly. And they go, oh, well, you're a five. And so that critique disposition is built into everything for me. And I'm not going to stop sort of valuing that process, but it's been helpful for me to learn from you and now from Dr. Branson, that there are other and often more valuable ways of engaging in conversation and moving forward.
So as we're thinking about moving forward, we're looking at season two, and we've got some cool ideas on the table right now, and I'm excited for season two. We've actually got two of the interviews already done, and at the same time I say that, we are very much, so this is an open invitation. Please contact us. There is contact links available on the website. You know, get a hold of Greg and I and call us up. Email us, let us know if you have any suggestions, if there's things or people that you'd like to hear from, questions that you'd like to hear addressed. We're open to that. And for season two, what we're hoping to do is, well, what are we doing, Greg, for season two? Tell us about that.
Well, so for season two, let me tell you the story of how we made this decision.
Yes.
We were about halfway through recording and producing season one, yeah, when Lyman Sané died.
Yeah.
And that caused both of us to kind of go, oh, who do we need to be talking to right now, yeah, while we still can?
Yeah.
And so we've moved toward a second season in which we are looking for interviews, hoping to land interviews with some of the elder statesmen and elder stateswomen of missiology, who are late in their career or late in their life, and we definitely want to hear their voice again. And so that's our hope for season two.
We hope that you're going to join us for season two, and please share these podcasts with your classes, with folks from church, maybe they're even discussion groups. Please share, get the word out there that there's a podcast that is, intentionally doing its best to, to make the some of these great missiological voices accessible. But also, that's also going to give you a fuller picture of these significant authors in the field.
Absolutely. And do please support us. You have there on the missiology.com/podcast page. Patreon button, and you can send some love our way. We have overhead, and we'd love for your help covering that.
Thanks again, listeners.
Yep, thanks so much. Have a great summer.